Well, hey, good evening. How's everybody? You know, when I was at the University of North Carolina, I was in a fraternity and smoked a lot of dope. And we used to sit around a lot of times when we were smoking dope and talk about kind of how the universe happened. Now, the reason we used to do that is because I really wanted to talk about that. And so we would, you know, take our turns. And then we would talk about kind of how the universe really happened to come into being. And after a while, my fraternity brothers got to the place where they said, "Lon, this is stupid. You know, why do you always want to talk about this? You're such a downer, man. You are such a bummer. I mean, you know, nobody knows the answer to this stuff. Forget about it. Trees are trees, man. They are just there. You know, other stuff is just there. I mean, you don't have to know why it's there. You don't have to know how it got there. You don't have to understand all this stuff. Just accept the fact it's there and let's get on with life." I don't know, that wasn't good enough for me. I had to have some better answers than that. And you know, I doubt if there's a single person in the world, from the pygmies in deepest, darkest Africa, to the politicians in deepest, darkest Congress, who sometimes don't kick back and say to themselves, "Hey, where did all of this stuff come from? How did the world come into existence? And where did life come from? And why are things on this planet the way they are?" Over the next 3 or 4 weeks, that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about these very questions. Where did all this stuff come from? And why is our world the way that it is? And even more important than that, how does all of this affect my life? What difference does it make to me? Now, you might wonder, "Well, Lon, why would you pick a subject like this to talk to us about? I mean, to come in here and talk to Frontline about this, why would you do this?" Well, that's a good question. There are really two reasons. Reason number one is that I believe that the truths that are in Genesis chapters 1 through 3 in the Bible, that these truths have unbelievable impact on our world today, the way we live, our worldview, the way we act, and so we need to talk about these things. The other reason is because I have learned that for many Americans, especially many Americans under the age of 40, who were brought up in the public education system of America, who've been taught the evolutionary model for the universe, I have learned that the Bible's claims regarding how the world came into being represent a major obstacle, a major stumbling block for many people for making a decision for Jesus Christ. I mean, they can't even get to a decision for Jesus Christ because they can't get past this idea that the Bible is so out of kilter with how science says the world came into being that's where they stop. And for these folks, and maybe you're one of these folks here tonight, we as Christians must be able to demonstrate that the Bible's explanation for how the world came into being and how life got here is at least plausible, that at least it's possible. Now, will I be able to prove to you that Genesis chapter 1 and 2 and 3 are right? Can I prove to you that the world came into being exactly the way Genesis says? No, I can't. There's no way I can. By the way, may I remind you, people who hold the evolutionary model can't prove to you either that the world came into being the way they said it came into being. Nobody can. None of us was there, and we have no hard scientific evidence from when the world was created. But all I want to try to do in the next couple of weeks is to demonstrate to you that the Bible's account is at least possible. That it's not as far-fetched, and it's not as harebrained, and it's not as crazy as your science teacher in high school told you it was, or some teacher in college told you it was, and that, as a matter of fact, the more we learn, the more the Bible's account looks like it makes even more sense than so many of the other theories that are involved. Okay? That's what we're going to try to do. And so to do that, I want you to take a Bible, and I want you to open it to Genesis chapter 1. Now, if you didn't bring a Bible, we want you to borrow our copy of the Bible, and we're going to be on page 1 of our copy of the Bible. That's easy enough, right? That's page 1. Now, you say, "Well, Lon, wait a minute. Just before we begin here, I have a question for you. And here's my question. What makes you competent to talk to us about these very complex, very intricate and technical scientific issues? I mean, no offense, Lon, or anything, but you're just a preacher, you know?" Well, no offense taken, okay? But let me respond to that and say to you, it's a good question. And you should know that I didn't do my undergraduate training in preaching. I didn't do my undergraduate training in religion or theology or anything. My degree from the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill is a BS in chemistry, and that BS does not stand for bull dookie. You understand? It stands for 60 hours of college credit chemistry, over 30 hours of college credit math and physics. So even though I've never won a Nobel Prize or anything, I've got enough background that I feel like I can talk to you about this and be at least reasonably intelligent in talking to you about it. So, with that little bit of explanation, let's look at what the Bible has to say, first of all, about exactly how did the world come into being? What does the Bible say about it? Well, look, verse 1. In the beginning, God. Now, let's stop there for just a second. Not in the beginning man, or in the beginning protoplasm, or in the beginning amoebas, or primeval sludge. Not in the beginning nitrogen, oxygen, carbon, and lightning. Not in the beginning dark matter or in the beginning quarks. But in the beginning, God. When there were no living creatures anywhere, when there was no earth for them to live on anyhow, when there was no energy, no light, no heat, when there was no matter of any kind, no atoms, no molecules, no protons, no neutrons, no electrons, when there was nothing, the Bible says, there was God. In the beginning, there was God. And what did God do? Well, look, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, the Hebrew verb here, created, is a Hebrew word, bara, and it's a very interesting Hebrew word. The word bara, the Hebrew verb to create, is never used with anyone else as its subject but God. In other words, what we're saying is that only God can bara. People never bara. Say, Lon, thank you very much for telling me that. Always wondered if I could bara, and now I know I can't bara, so thank you for clearing that up for me. Well, now, wait a minute. This is important, because the Hebrew word bara means to create something from nothing. That's what it means. And when the Bible says that God barad the heaven and the earth, what it means is that when it comes to the universe and everything we see around us, it means that God took nothing and God made everything that we see and everything that exists. Now, this is something that you and I as human beings can't do. We can take something and make something out of something, but we can't take nothing and make something out of nothing. Did you follow that? Sure you did. And that's why this verb bara is never used with a human being as the subject. But the Word of God declares to us that God is so awesome, and God is so powerful, and God is so unlimited in His power, that He can bara, that He did bara, that He took nothing and He made it into the stars and the galaxies and the planets and this earth and all the living creatures that we see around us. So here we have the clear, simple, definitive answer that the Bible gives as to how all this stuff got here. In the beginning, God created it out of nothing. Time magazine had an interesting article called Unraveling the Universe. And here's what it says in there. It says, and I quote, "The experts don't know for sure how old or how big the universe is. They don't know for sure what most of it is made of. They don't know for sure in any detail about how it began or how it will end. And beyond our local cosmic neighbors, they don't know for sure very much about what it looks like." Now, that being true, wouldn't you think that these scientists would at least be open to the idea of giving the Bible's account at least a chance to be right? Wouldn't you think that that would make sense considering how little they know? But they're not open to that. You say, why, Lon? Well, I'll tell you. It's a very simple answer. You see, if a person admits that the world was created, then automatically we have to admit there was a creator. And if there's a creator, then to create all of this stuff, he's obviously got to be more powerful than you and I are. He's got to be more awesome than you and I are. And if he's that awesome and powerful, then we should be subject to him. We should be humble before him. We should seek his will for our life. We should run our society by his rules. We should plan to get to heaven his way. And folks, the harsh reality of the situation is that that level of capitulation, that level of surrender to a creator God is a level of capitulation that these experts are not prepared to allow in their lives. They're not going to let somebody tell them what to do. They're not going to serve anybody. They're not going to run their lives by anybody else's rules. And so the only choice they have is to come up with an alternate theory of how the universe began. No matter how cockamamie it may be, the only thing that has to be true of it is that there's no creator in it. They can't have a creator in it because they're not prepared to deal with a creator. You say, well, Anna, I hear you. I mean, I see where you are. I understand that. But I got a few whatabouts to ask you. All right? Let's do it. Okay, first of all, Lon, what about the fact that almost no scientists in the whole world agree or think that the Bible's account can be right? What about that? Well, that's not true. First of all, there are a lot more scientists than most of us realize who either reject the evolutionary model of the universe or at least have very serious doubts about the evolutionary model of the universe. I got a few of them that I wrote down here. Let me read you. For example, quoting from Science Digest, and I quote, "Scientists who utterly reject evolution may be one of our fastest growing minorities in the scientific community. Many of these scientists hold impressive credentials in science," end of quote. William D. Hamilton, Oxford University professor, biologist, not a Christian. "The theological possibility that explains the origin of the universe is still certainly alive," end of quote. Several years ago, 60 world-class scientists, including 24 Nobel Prize winners, produced a book called Cosmos, Bios, and Theos. And in this book, Yale physicist Dr. Henry Morgenthau said this, and I quote, he says, "There is only one convincing answer for the intricate laws that exist in the natural world, and that is creation by an omnipotent, all-wise God," end of quote. Now, this guy was not from Jerry Falwell's place. This guy was from Yale University. You understand what I'm saying? Paul Davies, physicist, not a Christian. And I quote, "The very fact that the universe is creative and that it has permitted complex structures to emerge and develop to the point of consciousness. In other words, the very fact that the universe has organized its own self-awareness is for me powerful evidence." Listen to what Dr. Davies says. "Powerful evidence that there is something going on behind it all. The impression of design is overwhelming," end of quote. And last of all, historian Ronald Numbers of the University of Wisconsin, who studies the whole debate between creationists and evolutionists, and here's what he said. He said, and I quote, "Published scientists with creationist beliefs are not uncommon," end of quote. You see, friends, you've been duped into believing that every scientist in the world has bought into the evolutionary model and that every scientist in the world completely endorses it. That is absolutely untrue. You say, okay, Lon, well, then I got another what about. What about the age of the universe? What about the age of the earth? I mean, the Bible presents a picture of a very young world, and yet scientists tell us that the world is 4 billion, 10 billion, who knows how many billion years old. You know, Carl Sagan, billions and billions and billions of years. Well, you know why scientists are so committed to a world that's billions and billions of years old, don't you? Because the odds, the probabilities of human life, like you and me, developing through evolution is so infinitesimally small that the only way to even make it remotely possible is to give it billions and billions of years to happen in. Within any shorter time frame, it is absolutely mathematically impossible. That's why they argue for such an old age of the earth. It's not happenstance. Believe me, there's a bias behind it. But what about this, okay? What about it? Well, scientists use a variety of methods to calculate the age of the universe and the age of the world, but two of the most common are radioactive dating and the expanding universe. So let's talk about each of them for just a little bit, a second here. What about this idea of radioactive dating? What about measuring the decay rates of carbon, uranium, and other isotopes and figuring out from that the age of the Earth? Well, here is an evolutionist. His name is Dr. Frederick Uniman. And listen to what he said, not a Christian. He says, the age of our globe is presently thought to be some 4.5 billion years based upon radioactive decay rates of uranium and thorium. He goes on to say, there has been in recent years the horrible realization that radioactive decay rates are not as constant as previously thought, nor are they immune to environmental influences. And what this means is that the atomic clocks may have to be reset when you consider that there may have been some global disaster, and that actually the events that brought the Mesozoic age to a close may not have been 65 million years ago, but within the age and memory of man. End of quote. Now, can you think of any global disaster, possibly, that could have maybe reset the atomic clocks of this world? Can you think of one? Well, how about, you know, Noah and all the two-by-twos on the little boat? You remember that? Well, you know, the Bible tells us that all of that water that covered the earth did not come from rain. You could not rain enough water to do that. If you read very carefully, Genesis chapter 6 says that the well springs, the fountains of the deep were broken up. Most of that water came as a result of cracks in the earth's crust, and whether there was water that came out or whether simply the heat of all that molten material caused the oceans to swell, I don't know. But this was not an event that was just rain. And if the earth's crust was busted open, and if all kinds of molten material came out and things soaked in it for a year, I'm telling you, radioactive decay information is completely invalid. We do not have a uniform closed system, and it makes absolutely no sense to use that as a way to date the earth. We have polluted information. You say, well, okay, but what about this expanding universe deal? I mean, we're given the impression that this is a very finely tuned scientific exercise and that the results are airtight. You measure everything and, I mean, it comes out perfect. Well, let me read to you from an article in Time magazine entitled Unraveling the Universe. Listen to this. It says, astronomers have known since Hubble's heyday in the 1920s that you need only two pieces of information to deduce the age of the universe. You need to know how fast the galaxies are flying apart, and you need to know how far away they are. The ratio of these two numbers tells you how fast the cosmos is expanding, and a simple calculation then tells you how long it's been since the expansion started. Simple enough, right? Well, but listen, it goes on to say there are these two loopholes, though, notes University of Oklahoma astrophysicist David Branch. What is the right distance and what is the right speed? And listen to the conclusion they come to. These loopholes are big enough to drive the Starship Enterprise through. End of quote. You know, what this is telling us is that this is not an exact science measuring the expansion of the universe. And there's actually a lot of evidence that's coming to light lately to indicate that the Earth is actually very young. For example, John Baumgartner, a geophysicist at the Los Alamos National Laboratory out in the West Coast, he presented evidence at a 1994 geophysics conference where he said that he had evidence that the slip sliding of the Earth's plates, you know, the geological plates of the Earth, actually once might have happened at thousands of times the rate that they happen today, and if this is true, then the Earth is actually very young. And he's published this now in a scientific journal, and it's causing all kinds of reevaluation. But friends, here's what I'm here to tell you. The Earth's age is still up for grabs. There's no proof for sure that the Earth is 4 billion years old. You say, well, Lon, I got one more what about. Okay, ask it. What about the Big Bang? I mean, the Big Bang, you know. I mean, it seems that the Big Bang accounts pretty well for how the universe came into being. You know what? You're right. It does. Absolutely. And so I want you to listen to the words of Dr. Robert Jastrow, not a Christian, an astronomer, an agnostic. Listen to what he said about the Big Bang, and I quote. He said, astronomers now find that they have painted themselves into a corner because they have proven that the world began abruptly in an act of creation to which you can trace the seeds of every star, every planet, every living thing in the cosmos and on Earth. The scientists' pursuit of the past ends in a moment of creation. This is an exceedingly strange development, unexpected by everybody except the theologians. And then he went on to conclude by saying this, what we see is that the evidence from astronomy leads to a biblical view of the origin of the world. This guy's not a Christian now. The details may differ, but the essential elements that comes from the model of astronomy and the model of the Bible accounts in Genesis are one in the same, end of quote. Very interesting, isn't it? Very interesting. Now, you know, I have one more what about. Maybe you wouldn't have thought of this, but in doing the work for this message, I came up with one more what about, and that is, what about the fact that our world, the Earth, seems so absolutely perfectly suited for life, and that even tiny little changes in the way the Earth is and the way the cosmos is around the Earth would have meant life on Earth could never have happened. Listen, Time Magazine, once again, and I'd like to read to you just a quick little paragraph that points this out. It says this. It says, one intriguing observation that has bubbled up from physics is that the universe seems calibrated for life's very existence. If, for example, the force of gravity were pushed upward just a tiny bit, stars would burn out faster, leaving little time for life to evolve on the planets circling them. If the relative masses of protons and neutrons were changed by a hair, stars would never be born since the hydrogen they eat wouldn't exist. If at the Big Bang some basic numbers, like the initial conditions, had been jiggled just a tiny bit, matter and energy would never have coagulated into galaxies, stars, planets, or any other platform stable enough for life as we know it, and so on. End of quote. And what they're really saying is that the universe, it looks like, has been precisely tweaked in such a way to support life on Earth. There's an interesting article by a guy named Dr. Hugh Ross, and what he did is he's a physicist, he listed some 72 characteristics of the universe and of our solar system that are so fine-tuned, so perfectly fine-tuned, that if any one of them, of the 72, was just slightly different, life on Earth would be impossible. 72 of these. And then he went on to calculate the probability that all 72 of these conditions could occur with regard to any one planet in the universe, and the probability he came up with was 1 chance in 10 to the 65th power. That is 1 chance in 10 million trillion trillion trillion. Now, folks, I want to tell you something. It takes faith to believe either model. It takes faith to believe that in the beginning God made the heaven and the earth. It takes faith to believe the evolutionary model. But I got to tell you, in light of those numbers that we've just read, I'm very sorry, but I do not have enough faith to be an atheist. I just do not have that much faith. Those numbers are too impossible. I can't relate to those numbers. They make no sense to me. I'm sorry. Don't have enough faith to be an atheist. And let me read you a concluding statement by Dr. Jastrow, our agnostic astronomer. Here's what he said. He said, for the astronomer who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. And as he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries saying, in the beginning, God made the heaven and the earth. End of quote. Is that a wonderful end? Well, hey, all I can tell you is, have we proved that Genesis 1 is right? No. Can we prove Genesis 1 is right? No. cannot do that. But I hope at least I've been able to suggest to you tonight that Genesis 1 is not as wrong as everybody has been telling you it is. That it's not as implausible and impractical and far-fetched and nonsensical and stupid as everybody has tried to convince you. That there is a lot of reason to say Genesis chapter 1's account of how the world happened could very well be the most intelligent of all the theories. And if you're here and you've never trusted Jesus Christ in a real and personal way, and this has been a huge hang-up for you, I'm here to tell you that Genesis chapter 1 is, in my personal opinion, a reasonable, plausible, scientifically acceptable theory for how the world came into being, and that's all we could ever say about it because you can't prove it, and neither can I. Now you say, well, Lon, that's wonderful, and you know, great, and But you know, it really leads us to the most important question. Now, folks, the most important question for the morning crowd is, so what? But I had some friends in Frontline come to me and say, you know what, Lon, so what is cheesy. So tonight we're going to take a vote. And I want to offer you another alternative. I mean, I want to offer you so what, but if you think it's cheesy, then the other alternative I want to offer you is whatever. So we're going to vote. How many people like so what better? Okay, how many people like whatever better? All right, I think whatever wins. So from now on in Frontline, when we say the most important question, is
whatever.
All right, can y'all remember that? Whatever. Now, whatever, Lon. I mean, what difference does this make to my everyday life? Monday to know that God made that tree. Whatever. So what difference does that make to me? Oh, it makes a huge difference, friends. A huge difference. And here's the difference it makes. You see, if there is a God, the way the Genesis chapter 1 says, and if this God created the world the way Genesis chapter 1 says, then what that means is that we are not the victims of random fate when we live here. We are not the victims of senseless events. We're not like pawns being pushed around by who knows what. We're not like soccer balls being kicked around by random events in the universe. But rather, it means that there is a sovereign, supernatural creator God who is running the whole show. And that's important. Because you know what? That's not just intellectual theory when you're going through tough times. You know where I was before I came here tonight? I went to the father-daughter dance. We have a father-daughter dance that's just getting over at the McLean Hilton. And I took my little my little six-year-old girl, Jill, who, as many of you know, has a very serious medical condition. She has a seizure disorder. She's 6 years old, but she has the mental development of about a nine-month-old or maybe less. And they were very nice to us over there. We dressed her up in a real pretty dress, and they gave me the chance to have the first dance with her for about 30 seconds out on the dance floor. And so I picked her up and held her in my arm and took her out there and danced with her. And then everybody else came kind of out there and danced. And that was very sweet of them to let us do that. But you know what? My daughter had no clue where she was. She had no clue she was at a father-daughter dance. She had no clue she was dancing with her dad. She had no clue that this was a memory that she would remember her the rest of her life, because she won't. She was totally clueless. And as far as we can tell, the medical doctors tell us that we have no reason to think that she's going to get any better. This is probably where she's going to be her whole life. It was a very painful evening to be over there and see other dads with little six-year-old daughters that were fine, who knew they were there, who knew they were dancing with their dad, who would always remember being there and dancing with their dad, and who would go on to dance with their dad a lot more and do a lot of other neat things with their dad that my daughter, you know, apart from miracles, never going to do with me. It was a difficult evening. So how do I explain this? How do I integrate all this into my life? How do I deal with this pain? I mean, is all of this just the result of some freak genetic accident? I mean, is that the explanation for this? Is that the way I've got to explain it and try to compartmentalize it and deal with it in my life? See, that doesn't give me a lot of comfort. That doesn't give me a lot of hope. And that's not how I see it, friends. I see that there is a sovereign, Creator God, a supernatural God running this universe, and that the reason Jill is in my life and the life of my wife and my family is because there is a God running the universe with a perfect plan for my life, my family's life, and my little girl's life, and that He put her there. And you know, I've got some promises from that God in the Bible. Jeremiah 29:11, "For I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord. Plans for good, not for evil. Plans to give you a future and a hope." Now, if there's no real Creator God, and if Genesis chapter 1 is a myth, and if all of this happened by the evolutionary model, then that promise is not worth the paper it's printed on. God is just a dream somebody made up. There's no comfort for me in that promise. No comfort for me anywhere in the universe about my daughter. But if Genesis 1 is right, if there really is a sovereign God running this thing, if Jill is not an accident of genetics, but if she's part of a plan for my life and my family's life that's for good and to give us a future and a hope, and there's really a supernatural God making sure that happens, and even though I don't understand it, and even though I can't fully explain it, and even though I don't see where it's going yet, friends, that brings me comfort. That brings me hope. That brings me encouragement. That gives me the strength I need to hang on and the faith I need to keep trusting God. Don't tell me this doesn't have anything to do with your Monday to Saturday life. It has everything to do with your Monday to Saturday life, and everything to do with how you deal with the circumstances that come into your life. And you say, "But yeah, Lon, but how do you explain that God gives a sick little girl like that to people?" You know what, folks? I don't have the answer to that. I'm not smart enough to know that. And I want to tell you something. I've gotten to the place where I don't even have to know that anymore. I've gotten to the place where I can just leave it with God and say, "Lord, I just trust you. I don't understand it. But I know this, and I believe this, that when I get to heaven, if it still even matters anymore, that God, if I really want Him to, is going to take me over and explain to me how all of this fit into His perfect plan to give me a future and give me a hope for good and not for evil." And I know I'll shake my head in the affirmative when He does it, and I'll say, "You know what, Lord? I didn't see it, I didn't understand it, but You were right. You were right. If I need that, He'll give it to me. If you need that, He'll give it to you." But folks, in the meantime, if He's who He says He is and Genesis 1 is right, then everything is in His control and He can take care of you. And you can trust Him that He's putting together a future and a hope for you, even through the hard times, even through the disappointments, even through the heartbreaks, that they all fit in to a future and a hope that God has for you. "All things work together for good," God says, "to those who love Him, to those who trust Him." And I'm prepared to simply take it at face value and say, "I can live with that. And God, I know You're going to turn this into good somehow." Friends, if God is big enough to create the universe, and if He's big enough to keep the Crab Nebula from bumping into the Andromeda, you know, galaxy and all this other stuff, believe me, He can take care of you. Whatever your needs are, God can take care of you. And what He needs you to do is stop trying to figure everything out. Stop trying to explain everything. Stop trying to have answers to everything, but just to trust the fact there's a supernatural Creator God and that He's running your life, if you're a Christian, to have a future and a hope. Genesis 1 has enormous ramifications, if it's correct, for our everyday lives today. And you know what we're going to talk about next week is how not the world got here and creation got here, the universe. We're going to talk about how you and I got here. I mean, how did people who talk and walk and communicate and everything else we see on this planet, all the other living stuff, how did we get here? Was Darwin right? Was he? Well, come next week, that's what we're going to talk about. And then we're going to answer the question, whatever.